This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Good evening. My name is Lisa Loving. I'm the KBOO Evening News Director. Due to a massive computer failure at KBOO, which has yet to be repaired, we will not be able to present our normal locally produced broadcast tonight. We hope that the equipment will be repaired by Monday. And in the meantime, we are going to play tonight Free Speech Radio News in its uncut entirety, followed by Counterspin. Thank you for your patience. Have a wonderful weekend. And stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Counterspin.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 9th, 2006. Filling in for Otto Bogado, I'm Mitch Jesrich from Pacifica Station, WBAI, New York. As the World Cup begins in Germany today, the debate on sex trafficking in Germany's sex industry heats up. Against the wishes of Hamas, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas sets a date for a referendum that asks whether to recognize Israel. And former Republican House Leader Tom DeLay makes his final remarks on the House floor.
If conservatives don't stand up to liberalism, no one will.
We'll have these stories and more after these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. An Israeli missile hit a crowded Gaza beach this afternoon, killing a number of vacationing Palestinian civilians. Saeed Benoura reports.
The Israeli missile dropped on the crowded beach this afternoon, killed 11 Palestinians and wounded 40. Today's attacks followed an airstrike last night that killed the leader of the Popular Resistance Committees and three others. A separate attack killed three other Palestinians today in the northern Gaza Strip. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh.
These crimes and assassinations aim to break the will of the Palestinian people and to destroy any chance for a peaceful solution, to resume the unjust siege against the Palestinian people and government. Our people will remain steadfast, and we are sure that these sacrifices will not be in vain.
The Israeli military says it will investigate the incident, while Hamas military wing has pledged for the first time in over a year to resume attacks against Israel. The ongoing Israeli attacks on civilians in Gaza, combined with an international blockade that has prevented food, medicine, and paychecks from reaching Palestinians, have made life for Palestinians in the occupied territories reach a breaking point. For Afas Aran, this is Saad Banoura from Beit Sahour, Palestine.
A U.S. district judge has ruled that a confession allegedly obtained by torture may be used as evidence in a terrorism case to be held in Chicago. Shannon Heffernan has the story.
In the months leading up to the decision, the judge met with Israeli soldiers to discuss their alleged use of torture during the interrogation of Mohamed Salah. Salah, a U.S. citizen, was arrested by Israeli soldiers in 1993 at a checkpoint leading into the Gaza Strip. Israeli authorities say that Salah was bringing funds to aid Hamas, which Israel considers a terrorist organization. Salah says the money he was arrested with was for humanitarian aid. The defense team was not allowed in the meetings between the judge and the Israeli soldiers, allegedly due to security concerns. Michael Deutsch, Salah's defense attorney, says the decision sets two very dangerous precedents.
One, the use of evidence obtained by torture from a foreign government, and two, accepting the allegations of these torturers to be that it's classified and having secret proceedings where the public, the press, and even the defense is not allowed to be present.
Mohamed Salah spent 5 years in an Israeli prison before returning to his home in a Chicago suburb. In 2004, the U.S. government charged Salah with aiding terrorists. The case will go to trial in October of this year. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Heffernan in Chicago.
An AP Ipsos poll conducted Monday through Wednesday of this week has found that 59% of those surveyed feel that the war in Iraq is a mistake. The poll also found President Bush's approval rating to be at 33%. Disapproval of the way in which the president is handling the war in Iraq is over 70% for women, unmarried men, people of color, city dwellers, and people from households earning less than $25,000 a year. An amendment to ensure internet neutrality was defeated yesterday in the House of Representatives. The amendment was part of a larger telecommunications bill known as the Communications Opportunity Promotions and Enhancement Act, which aims to ease government regulations and allow telephone companies to enter into the cable industry. The COPE Act, passed by a large margin after the defeat of the amendment that would have imposed strong government regulations to ensure that Internet service providers give equal treatment to all Internet traffic and websites, a concept known as net neutrality. The amendment's supporters feel the giant telecommunications and cable companies will create a pay-based, two-tiered system that website hosts will have to buy into. Service providers said the amendment was unnecessary, arguing that the government would be trying to regulate something that hasn't been problematic. The amendment sponsor, Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, said that the vote would forever change the open and democratic nature of the Internet. Bad weather is preventing the cleanup of a massive oil spill on the shores of the Indian state of Goa. The spill has severely affected marine life and local fishing communities. Gloria Kamkar reports.
Fishing activity around the shoreline of Goa in India has been badly affected for the last week, and there is panic amongst the fishermen, especially the marginal ones who go fishing close to the shore and operate without the help of automatic trawlers. Many dead fish have been washed ashore in the last 1 week after Ocean Sereya broke into two parts in South Goa. The vessel had 650 metric tons of furnace oil on board when it hit an island on its way to Karwar port. Scientists and environmentalists are also worried about long-term effects that might have on the aquatic life in the region. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Gloria Khamkar from Pune in India.
Virginia Governor Tim Kaine has issued a 6-month stay of execution for Percy Walton, who was scheduled to die last night for a 1996 triple homicide. Walton's attorneys say he is insane and mentally retarded. Walton will face a mental health evaluation before his new execution date. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is expected to sign a decree on Saturday setting the date of July 31st for a national referendum that includes the question as to whether to recognize Israel. However, Hamas is warning that such a referendum could split the people. Munar Jabrim has more.
On May 25th, President Mahmoud Abbas gave a 10-day ultimatum to all Palestinian factions, mainly the Hamas movement, to discuss the conciliation document and to resolve the disputed issues in it. And that's what the factions, mainly Hamas and Fatah, have attempted to do during a series of meetings over the past 12 days. But even extension on the 10-day deadline, Hamas continues to reject the document and says a referendum would be illegal so soon after the elections. Anwar Zboun, Hamas legislator, says that the approval of the referendum would in effect amount to an overturning of the vote for Hamas held months earlier.
This is deceit. They tend to ignore the parliamentary elections which took place a few months ago. 60% of the Palestinian people elected the resistance choice, the program of the Islamic movement, for liberation and independence. Now, they're trying to pressure the people with this choice. They could not break the people with the isolation and by not paying them their salaries. So now, they are evading the democratic choice of the Palestinians with what they call the referendum.
The document includes 18 articles, one of which carries an implicit recognition of Israel, and another calls for the reactivation and restructuring of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the sole and legitimate representative of all Palestinians, to include all factions. The referendum may result in either the resignation of the Palestinian president or the dissolution of the Hamas government, which means a new round of early elections. In the midst of a looming financial crisis and mounting political pressures, Mohammed Al-Hurani, member of Fatah Revolutionary Council, says there is a need to strengthen the Arab and international links for the Arab Peace Initiative. The initiative was adopted during the 2002 Arab Summit in Beirut. In response, the Israeli army invaded and reoccupied most of the West Bank cities. The Arab initiative called for the full recognition of Israel and normalization with Israel for a full Israeli withdrawal to the pre-1967 borders. Mohammed Al-Hurani.
We have two options, either isolation, and we have the right to ask for this, or to work on the prisoner's document, which adopts a political program very close to that of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Doing so will enable us to reactivate the Arab and international links and break the political and economic isolation which is threatening the lives of the Palestinian community.
For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has just finished a visit to the Kingdom of Jordan, where he attempted to quell Jordanian fears of Israel's potential plan of unilaterally drawing up its borders with Palestine. From Amman, Ula Farawati has the story.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's visit to the kingdom came in the midst of growing Arab concern that the newly elected prime minister will go ahead with a plan to fix the Jewish state's borders, even without an agreement with the Palestinians. Jordanian political analyst Manar Rashwani.
This visit is very important because it was needed for Jordan to express a united Arab concern over Olmert's unilateral plan, which is going to leave a big impact on Jordan. And at the same time, the king said yesterday, Jordan will never be an alternative country. And it was important that Jordan relays the message.
King Abdullah, at the end of the meeting yesterday, said that a two-state solution reached through bilateral Palestinian-Israeli negotiations should be the only solution sought. He also affirmed that Jordan will never be open for Palestinians if Palestinians would be driven into Jordan if Olmert follows through with the convergence plans and starts annexing parts of the West Bank. The Arabs are becoming increasingly concerned over Olmert's plan, which envisions the annexation of settlements and the demarcation of Israeli borders by 2010, even without negotiations with the Palestinians. Al-Qaeda number 2 Ayman Zawahiri warned that Arabs and Palestinians will never arrive at peace by negotiating with Israel. He expressed concern in a televised speech on Al Jazeera television that Israel was paying lip service to peace negotiations only to divert Arab attention from creating an independent state.
You will never arrive at independence. America and Israel simply do not want peace. And this is part of the alleged American interference in the Middle East. You will never be independent because you are living in states that are occupied, and Israel will not grant you your independence because this will be the end of an Israeli state.
Al-Zawahiri urged Palestinians to reject a referendum on a statehood proposal that implicitly recognizes Israel as a state. Palestinian officials said President Mahmoud Abbas will hold a referendum on July 31. Major Western donors led by the United States froze direct aid to Palestinian government after Hamas Islamists won January elections and refused to recognize Israel, renounce violence, or embrace interim Israeli-Palestinian peace deals. Hamas took the opportunity to re-emphasize its stance on the referendum and the occupation. Hamas spokesperson in Lebanon, Osama Hamdan.
We emphasize that our stance is rejecting the referendum, and we refuse to be asked about our rights to be in Palestine or our right to resist occupation.
In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Last night, former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay gave his final remarks on the House floor before retiring from Congress. In his speech, he held the conservative way and called liberalism the wrong way, crediting himself with the rise of conservative power in Congress.
If conservatives don't stand up to liberalism, no one will. And for a long time around here, almost no one did. Indeed, the common lament over the recent rise in political partisanship is often nothing more than a veiled complaint instead about the recent rise of political conservatism.
By the end of his 20-minute speech, most Democrats had stood up and walked out. Democrats are pushing to keep his name on the November ballot in Texas. Today, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a $22 billion foreign operations bill, which provides $2.3 billion in military aid to Israel and another $1.3 billion in military aid to Egypt. However, the House rejected an amendment to cut funding for WINSEC, formerly known as the School of the Americas, that has been accused of training Latin American military officers who have gone on to commit war crimes. It also rejected an amendment to channel money away from Colombia's drug fumigation operations to refugee assistance. Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill.
Citing numerous cases of human rights abuses made by graduates of the School of Americas, some members of Congress made an attempt to cut funding for the Latin America military training camp. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee from California says the school gives the U.S. a bad name in Latin America.
In 1996, the Pentagon released reports explaining how the United States trained these students to participate and to lead torture, extortions, and executions in Latin America. And now many countries in the region are struggling to recover from decades of dictatorship, corruption, and human rights abuses.
Graduates of this school have been found or accused of committing human rights abuses, including carrying out death squads in their home countries. The school is also associated with implementing U.S.-backed regimes in the region. The School of the Americas closed in 2001, but it was replaced with the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Operations, or WINSEC. The school advertises their refurbished curriculum that includes courses in human rights. The school is located at Fort Benning, Georgia, and trains up to 1,000 military, law enforcement, and civilian personnel from Latin America, one-third of which come from Colombia. But opponents of the amendment say the school is essential and that most of the graduates follow the law. Republican Jim Colby from Arizona.
A large part of the curriculum in this program is devoted to human rights and the values. It seems to me that if what we really want in this hemisphere is a military in different countries that shares those values that we hold that are dear to us, that we should be doing more, not less of this, more training of these people.
But the group School of the Americas Watch say that human rights courses were taught in the 80s as well, and that was during the height of abuse and violence committed by some graduates. Christy Pardue with SOA Watch says the school is a reflection of the U.S.'s human rights policy.
I really think that the school doesn't have credibility when it comes to talking about human rights. And I think that that's really becoming true of our own government as well. I mean, everyone in the world has seen pictures of Abu Ghraib. And this administration, this government needs to be doing everything it can to change that message, to send a positive message, to say we do support human rights, we don't support torture. And I think that this amendment is a really strong way that we could do that right now.
Since 2004, three countries have refused to send students to the school: Venezuela, Argentina, and Uruguay. Another amendment in the Foreign Operations Bill would have taken $30 million from coca eradication programs in Colombia and transferred that money to refugee assistance programs. That amendment failed as well. The House provides more than $500 million to eradication programs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The World Cup begins in Germany today, and as up to 3 million soccer fans travel to the European nation, German officials and human rights activists are turning their gaze towards the issue of sex trafficking. The Parliamentary Assembly of Europe estimates that between 30 and 60,000 women will be kidnapped, coerced, or smuggled into Germany to serve as sex slaves during the World Cup period. Amnesty International is currently staging a campaign along with other German NGOs to bring awareness of the problem of trafficked women who are sexually exploited. However, German sex workers say the figures are being grossly exaggerated. Sex work has been legal in Germany since 2002, and sex workers say that the media hype is bad for business and represses migrant workers in the industry. Cinnamon Nippard reports from Berlin.
According to Amnesty International, most trafficked women are lured from poor families in Eastern European nations like Russia, the Ukraine, and Lithuania, with promises of well-paid positions in Western Europe. The promised job turns out to be prostitution. Their passports are taken away, and these women are brutally exploited. Gunda Opfer from Amnesty International Germany.
Maltreatment and rapes by the dealers are common practice. The women are not able or don't dare to go to police and accuse their pimps because they are told that they will be sent back to their home countries.
Amnesty International is calling on all European countries to ratify the European Convention Against Trafficking. And while they're also running a nationwide campaign to stop forced prostitution, Gunda Opfer says there's no way of knowing the exact figures.
The numbers 30,000 and 60,000 are naturally based on estimations. One of the properties of forced prostitution is the fact that it happens in secret and that the trafficked women are often kept at hidden places.
Veronica Monk is the chairperson of Amnesty for Women, an NGO providing legal advice and counselling for migrant women living in Hamburg. She's also the coordinator of TAMPEP, Germany, a transnational research, health and advocacy project for migrant sex workers in Europe. Monk says the trafficking figures put forward by the Parliamentary Assembly of Europe are incorrect.
This number is extremely exaggerated, is unreal,
Even the police say that's not true. From our experience, from almost 13 years, most of the women who work in the sex industry are not trafficked. Most of them, they come not only to Germany, but other European countries, knowing that they are going to work in prostitution. The thing they don't know are the conditions under which they are going to work.
In 2004, the German police found a total of 972 women had been trafficked into Germany. In the lead-up to the World Cup, they've conducted raids on brothels in three states and found no trafficked women at all. Stephanie Klee is a sex worker from Berlin who also runs a sex worker advocacy group. She also believes the trafficking problem has been overestimated.
I heard from some colleagues who are coming from Poland or from Spain or from Netherlands specially to work here during the World Cup. But they are not forced prostitutes. There is no violence behind them.
Out of 400,000 sex workers in Germany, 60% of these are migrants. Despite the fact that prostitution was legalized in Germany in 2002, Veronica Monk says it's the law that makes migrant workers vulnerable to exploitation.
The new prostitution law in Germany does not permit that a migrant person ask for a visa to enter Germany on a legal way and work here in prostitution on a legal way. So this means that from the beginning, migrants are extremely vulnerable because they are from the beginning dependent on third persons to get into Germany and to work here in prostitution. So one of the things we demand is the link of the prostitution law with the alien law.
In the wake of the Amnesty International campaign, fans and football players alike have been warned not to go to brothels in case the women working there have been forced into prostitution. But Veronica Monk says this media hype has adversely affected sex workers and the sex industry in Germany.
It's one of the arguments to repress even more migration and to repress or to control even more prostitution. And that's quite contradictory because in Germany we have a new law on prostitution, which is quite good. It was a very positive and important political move to the recognition of the rights of sex workers. And suddenly all this movement reducing sex workers to victims of trafficking, politically it's very negative because it destroys all what sex workers in Germany achieved through the new law.
As the World Cup gets underway, Amnesty International will be handing out booklets to raise awareness about trafficking, while sex work advocacy groups will be handing out condoms and flyers to potential clients, calling on them to treat sex workers with respect. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
In Colorado, activists gathered outside the annual shareholders meeting of a mining and exploration company to protest the company's mining activities in El Salvador. Free Speech Radio News' Maeve Conran reports from Denver.
O Martinique Silver is a Canadian exploration company headquartered in Denver. According to the company's website, El Salvador is prime hunting ground for precious metal deposits. It has been issued a license to explore areas in the Chalatenango region by the Salvadorian government, who claim that while the villagers may own the topsoil, the subsoil is national property. Therefore, local consent for exploration is not needed. But local Salvadorian communities oppose the mining, saying it will devastate the area. Santiago Serrano is a member of the Anti-Mining Commission in Chalatenango. He says the local communities want the area to be developed, but not exploited through mining.
We know that the transnationals can bring development, but development is for them, not for the communities.
After many years of violent war, Serrano says the people of El Salvador are now facing an economic war with transnational corporations seeking to exploit their natural resources. The proposed mining would pollute the land and destroy vegetation for the local subsistence farmers, and a proposed dam would divert the river, which provides water for the region. Mining corporations have been facing increased opposition from local communities. In April, anti-mining protests at the Newmont mine shareholders meeting prompted Newmont's CEO to meet delegates from communities affected by mining and hear their concerns. The Salvadorians wish to do the same thing with O Martinique by teaming up with supporters in the US through their Sister City program and with the local anti-mining activists in Colorado. they wish to tell the O-Martinique shareholders that the mine does not have the support of the local community. Glenn Spagnolo, a local activist who was involved with the Stop Newmont Mining campaign, was to address the shareholders as a proxy on behalf of the Salvadorians.
The community is resisting their exploratory operations that are going on there, and they have never received any kind of social contract or any kind of agreement from the community members.
Glenn Morris of the Colorado American Indian Movement, the other proxy, said there are definite parallels between what is happening in Chalatenango and the Western Shoshone people in Nevada.
They're being marginalized and their communities are being threatened by another transnational corporation exploiting natural resources without the informed consent of the communities involved.
However, before the commencement of this morning's shareholders' meeting, both proxies were denied entry and told their proxies were invalid. After being escorted from the premises, they joined the other protesters outside the meeting. Spagnolo says that being denied access to the shareholders has just made their conviction even greater to fight for the rights of the communities in Chalatenango. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Colorado.
As gentrification resulting from skyrocketing real estate markets continue to impact communities throughout the United States, in Washington, D.C., the latest casualty to condominium development is a homeless shelter just blocks from the White House. Free Speech Radio News' Darby Hickey reports.
One sunny D.C. morning, a couple dozen residents of the Franklin Shelter for Homeless Men gathered with signs of protest on the sidewalk outside the building where they sleep each night. They planned to march to City Hall to state their opposition to a rumored lease of their temporary home to developers. One of the men, Romaine McBride, had attached a pay stub from his part-time job to the sign taped to his shirt, stating, "Save Franklin Shelter."
"This is to let the council know that not everybody that sleeps in the shelter doesn't have a job or doesn't try to get work. This is not my little part-time job. Also, I'm a registered voter. I have my voting card on. So it lets them know that not everybody in the shelter is just lay around drinking all up in the parks. We're not. Some of us are trying to get out, but it's a struggle. You don't have enough affordable housing."
Despite stares from passersby who associate the area with lobbyists and lawyers, McBride said it was important to show the decision makers in the district that his life is as valuable as that of a young professional looking for chic downtown living. Even with his job, McBride said he would be unable to find an affordable place to live in the city, and that closing the Franklin shelter would leave him and the close to 250 men staying there with no place to go but the streets. The district government has closed several shelters over the past couple years, and advocates say not enough has been done to replace the beds lost. Additionally, the government has placed new shelters much farther away from the center of town, in part because of gentrification, says Patricia Mulahi-Fougere, executive director of the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless.
"It's been trying to move folks who are homeless away from the downtown where most of the development has taken place. What the advocacy community has been pushing for, to keep shelter in the downtown so that it can be conveniently located to services and also jobs and other supports that people are connected to."
According to Mulahi-Fougere, D.C. does not have adequate housing for the number of people who are homeless, especially families. Meanwhile, thousands of new condominiums and renovated houses are coming onto the real estate market. The average cost of a single-family home in the D.C. area rose by almost 30% last year, while condo prices increased even more. The frenzy of construction of high-priced housing in cities across the country is having a serious impact on those who are already homeless, as well as those who are just a paycheck away from losing their housing, says Tulinos Degger of the National Law Center on Poverty and Homelessness.
"Basically, when people are, you know, forced to be in public spaces because they have no other way to go, there seems to be a lot of backlash, especially in areas that are gentrifying, where, you know, cities embark upon campaigns to, you know, do a so-called cleanup of areas. And in those cases, they may target homeless people through laws that make it illegal to sleep in public or sit on the sidewalk or do other things like that."
Franklin Shelter residents, advocates, and community activists say they will fight to keep the shelter open while pushing for a change in D.C.'s approach to homelessness, which must include a greater emphasis on low-income housing, they say. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Free Speech Radio News is an independent program produced out of Pacifica stations KPFK in Los Angeles and KPFA in Berkeley. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez, Simba Russo, and Aldo Bogado. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team is Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. Filling in for Aldo Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezerich in New York.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, a new proposal to Iran from the U.S. and five other nations seems to suggest the possibility of direct negotiations and has resulted in a more upbeat tone to a story that looked to be heading for crisis just a few weeks ago. What does the new proposal mean and how has it changed the tone of media coverage? We'll talk to Professor Michael Clare of Hampshire College in Massachusetts. Also on Counterspin today, media largely accept the White House's framing of the war on terror and the battle against militant Islam. That often means the press entertains very little discussion about where that movement comes from and where it might be headed. Fawaz Gerges of Sarah Lawrence College tries to provide some of the answers in his new book, Journey of the Jihadist. He'll join us to talk about that. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
After George W. Bush renewed his support for an anti-gay marriage constitutional amendment, media coverage has focused largely on the GOP's political maneuvering. In the misguided quest to find balance, NPR political editor Ken Rudin suggested that this was a routine political ploy of the sort both parties engage in. As he put it on CNN on June 5th, quote, "It's politics, not politics in a bad way, but it's politics. Democrats have done the same thing. They'll insist on a vote on raising the minimum wage. Not that they'll have it or not, but to put Republicans in the uncomfortable position of having to vote for or against it," close quote. One might point out that there's a significant legal and qualitative distinction between a constitutional amendment limiting the civil rights of Americans and a legislative attempt to give poor workers a raise. And while it's important for reporters to examine the politics behind Bush's endorsement of the amendment, particularly after a vote to move the amendment forward failed, as was expected, in the Senate, few reports examine what the actual effects of the proposed amendment would be. A June 6 Washington Post article allowed Bush and his supporters to frame the legal ramifications, reporting that Bush, quote, "took pains to note the limitations of the proposed amendment," close quote, and suggesting that other arrangements, like civil unions, would still be permitted. The New York Times and the Los Angeles Times similarly gave readers only the conservative camp's interpretation of the amendment. But it's far from clear that they're correct. The ACLU, for example, says the amendment would undermine civil unions, domestic partnerships, and other legal protections for gays and lesbians. News accounts should have added such voices to their reporting instead of relying simply on conservative spin.
A June 1st Christian Science Monitor editorial, "A Latin Leader Who Delivers," was practically ecstatic about the re-election of Colombian President Alvaro Uribe. According to the editors, Uribe has reduced homicides, kidnappings, and terrorism, and the paper emphasized he has made Colombians safer and richer. Not until paragraph 5 does the reader clearly see what the Monitor is up to. Quote, "Such success stands in contrast to the would-be leader of Latin America, President Hugo Chavez, who despite his populist rhetoric has yet to turn Venezuela's oil riches into making his country safer and more prosperous," close quote. The proof of Uribe's economic superiority to Chavez, according to the paper's editors, quote, "Colombia's economy grew about 5% last year, while Venezuela's economy has fallen more than 10% since Mr. Chavez took power in 1999, close quote. However, as Justin Delacour of the online Latin American News Review points out, the Monitor not only ignored Uribe's record of intimidating journalists and human rights groups, as well as his ties to brutal paramilitaries, according to Delacour, the editors have their economic facts wrong on Venezuela. The country's gross domestic product is 9% greater than it was when Chavez took office in 1998. And Delacour adds that Venezuela, over the last 2 years, boasts the fastest growing economy in the Western Hemisphere. As for the poor, Delacour writes, quote, the purchasing power of the country's two lowest income strata jumped 33% in 2004. Apparently, the Christian Science Monitor isn't going to let facts get in the way of some good old Chavez bashing. As the Monitor editors would have it, only pro-market Latin American leaders like Uribe deliver.
New York Times White House correspondent Elizabeth Buemiller is wrapping up her time on that beat, perhaps to the delight of Buemiller's many critics who found her soft coverage of the Bush administration a little hard to stomach. Buemiller didn't do much to change that perception when she explained why reporters didn't forcefully challenge the White House before the Iraq War. Quote, it's frightening to stand up there. Think about it. You're standing up on primetime live TV asking the President of the United States a question when the country's about to go to war. No one wanted to get into an argument with the president at this very serious time. Close quote. Give her points for honesty, I guess. Buemiller wrote a summary of her years on the job for the Times on June 4th, addressing some of the common misperceptions about the White House gig. But one item really stood out. Buemiller was trying to explain that the occasionally tense but rarely newsworthy White House briefings were not key to doing her job. The real work relies on old-fashioned reporting. But Buemiller explanation fell flat when she tried to give examples of what her digging produced. Buemiller and her colleagues spend much of their time talking to anonymous Republicans who share a little inside information about internal White House deliberations. The result? Well, Buemiller wrote that on two occasions those leakers, who were okayed by the White House to do just that, passed along information about minor personnel issues that proved to be correct. So you've covered this White House for 5 years, and that's what you've got to show for your investigation. It speaks volumes about Buemiller, and perhaps just as much about why the Times kept her in her job for so long.
If a politician tells a lie and no one reports it, does it make a sound? Surely deliberate distortions of fact on the part of powerful officials are among the more important occurrences in a democracy. Yet more and more journalists seem to be flat out declaring that if the one who's lying is George W. Bush, they will never report it as such. PBS NewsHour host Jim Lehrer is the latest to present this absurd and dangerous blind spot as a point of honor. As he explained in the June 2nd CJR Daily, quote, I don't deal in terms like blatantly untrue. That's for other people to decide when something's blatantly untrue. There's always a germ of truth in just about everything. My part of journalism is to present what various people say about it the best we can find out by reporting and let others, meaning commentators, readers, viewers, bloggers, or whatever. I'm not in the judgment part of journalism. I'm in the reporting part of journalism. Close quote. There are, of course, those who would suggest that someone who can report that a man states that 2 plus 2 is 5 without noting that this is not the case isn't really in any part of journalism at all.
And finally, on his May 29th show, Fox News' John Gibson accused opponents of the Iraq War of engaging in what he called a slime fest by calling attention to the apparent massacre of 24 civilians at Haditha, or in Gibson's words, quote, an incident in which our troops overreact and commit an arguably criminal act, close quote. But Gibson wanted to make it clear that he was not in favor of what happened at Haditha, saying, quote, I'm against massacres of civilians. I think we all are. Close quote. While it's true that a strong majority of people probably are anti-civilian massacre, Gibson unfortunately can't plausibly claim to be among them. Not having declared, as he did in March of last year, that democracy in Lebanon was a good thing, because if we didn't like who they elected, quote, we could bomb it back to the Stone Age with a clean conscience. Close quote. Gibson praised the November 2004 destruction of Fallujah by the U.S. Marines, saying, quote, Fallujah stands as a shot-to-pieces memorial to both the power of the U.S., but also the willingness of the U.S. to do what it takes, close quote. And even after it was revealed that British police had shot an innocent person as a terrorist suspect last July, Gibson declared, quote, got to admire the cojones of those Brit cops to go after him like that, close quote. Ah, yes, the stirring words of a man firmly opposed to civilian killings. Well, some of the time.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Just a few weeks ago, the May 22nd edition of The Nation magazine editorialized that the U.S., quote, is exaggerating the threat Iran poses, is making demands that go beyond Iran's treaty obligations, and is now pushing for a U.N. Security Council resolution that would impose sanctions and other punishments, close quote. The Nation accused U.S. and Iranian leaders of, quote, playing a reckless game of chicken, close quote. At the time, things seemed to be rushing towards a crisis situation. As we speak on June 8th, much has changed in the tone of the Iran story, largely due to a diplomatic proposal sent to Iran by a group of six nations, including the U.S., other members of the U.N. Security Council, and Germany. Joining us now to discuss these developments, as well as media coverage of Iran, is Michael Clare, Professor of Peace and World Security at Hampshire College. Professor Clare joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Michael Clare, welcome back to Counterspin.
My pleasure to join you.
Well, what is your reaction to this Iran proposal? Is it something new or not?
Well, it's certainly new in the sense that for the first time, the United States agreed to sit down at the bargaining table with Iran. Up until now, the United States has said it wouldn't ever negotiate with the Iranians. This goes back to the hostage crisis in 1979. Since then, we haven't spoken to the Iranians officially. And we've used the Europeans, the British, the French, and the Germans as intermediaries. The Iranians objected to this, and no progress was being made as a result. And now finally, the United States has agreed to negotiate directly with the Iranians, and that does represent a significant change.
Well, give us some of the details. What is involved in this proposal, this offer to Iran?
Not all of the details of the offer have been made public, but it appears that there, you know, as usual, there are a bunch of carrots and a bunch of sticks. What exactly the sticks are is a little less clear, but the carrots include promise of assistance to Iran's civilian nuclear industry if it gives up the pursuit of enrichment that could be used to make nuclear weapons. It also includes parts for Iran's aging American-made aircraft and a host of other economic incentives. Hanging in the background are threats to isolate Iran economically in the world community, to put a curb on international travel and so on if the Iranians don't agree to the package.
It's also not clear if the United States is agreeing to take an attack against Iran off the table or is insisting on a permanent cessation of Iran's enrichment program, is it?
Well, a lot of this still remains to be seen. And bear in mind that both sides are making comments for public consumption. At the same time, there are obviously behind-the-scenes moves underway that we probably don't know about, but probably indicate an effort by both sides to try to reach a compromise, or at least to sound out how far they're willing to go on each side. But we probably don't know all of the details of that. Still, I'm impressed that part of the discussion does include the possibility of a larger political settlement between Iran and the United States, some kind of discussion of Israel, recognition of Israel, of curbs on terrorism, in return for an American promise to eliminate the threat of regime change, because up until now it's always been hinted by the Bush administration that regime change in Iran was the ultimate objective of U.S. policy. Now, obviously, there's not going to be any grand bargain unless that's taken off the table.
On May 26th, Gareth Porter reported in the Asia Times of a secret Iranian offer made in 2003 that would have accepted much tighter controls by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, this secret offer looked a lot like what is on the table today. This would seem to contradict the media image of Iran as intransigent. Michael Clare, how do you see it?
Here again, it's a little bit hard for those of us who are in the United States, who don't speak the language and who don't have access to the various parties in Iran, and there are very few people who do have that kind of access. So it's clear that maneuvering takes place between the hardliners in the government and those who are interested in a more constructive relationship with the United States. And they're always, you know, one side will make a overture to the U.S. and then the other side, and I'm speaking of Iranian sides, the other side then will denounce any contact with the United States. It's a little hard to know how much of which is really the prevailing consensus, but my sense is that this earlier proposal does suggest that there's strong currents within the Iranian leadership that is interested in working out a grand bargain with the United States if the threat of regime change is eliminated on the U.S. side. And so I think there's a little bit of a testing of the waters underway here.
Mm-hmm. A front-page New York Times story on June 6th headlined, U.S. is offering deals on trade to entice Iran, reflected a more upbeat tone to the Iran story. The latest coverage has generally portrayed Iranian leaders as a little more reasonable and open. This is quite a contrast with coverage of the past few years when Fair has noted that the New York Times and other media outlets have largely echoed the White House's negative portrayals of the Iranian leadership. Michael Clare, give us your views about media coverage of this story before and since this latest proposal.
Well, my sense is that you only hear about Iran when their leaders say something totally outrageous. When the president, Ahmadinejad, spoke about wiping Israel off the map, when you hear about the Iranian leaders calling the United States the great Satan, all kinds of anti-American rhetoric, you know, we have to understand that this is part of the political discourse in Iran, just as in this country, if you scan the press and the comments of Republicans, you'll hear equally hostile remarks about the Iranians. But you only hear in the American press usually about the most extreme comments from the Iranian side. You rarely hear about more moderate statements by their leadership. They just don't get reported. So that's what strikes me most about the change in tone now.
Michael Clare, what do you think are the most crucial parts of the story?
Americans need to understand a little bit more about the state of Iran's nuclear activities. You almost get the impression from reading the headlines that Iran is on the verge of acquiring a large nuclear arsenal. Nothing could be further from the truth. They're at a very primitive, early stage in the development of technologies that could, maybe, over time, lead to the production of nuclear materials. The other issue that I think needs more attention is the way in which Iran's situation is complicated by their sense of insecurity. Now, we tend to portray Iran as a very threatening, muscular country, but I think if you speak to Iranian leaders and Iranian public, you find they feel very threatened. After all, there are American bases in Iraq on one side and Afghanistan on the other side. There are American warships in the Persian Gulf off the coast of Iran, and we rarely hear about this sense of insecurity that the Iranians feel that might be behind their push for nuclear weapons.
We've been speaking with Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. Michael Clare, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's been my pleasure.
There is no shortage of popular frameworks with which reporters and pundits have viewed the U.S.'s declared war on terrorism, a clash of civilizations, a struggle against Islamofascism, and so on. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman recently lamented America's situation in Iraq, writing that, quote, "We can't keep asking Americans to sacrifice their children for people who hate each other more than they love their own children," close quote. Well, surely there's more to the Iraq story story than a country of people who don't love their children, but understanding the movement that is political Islam would seem to be a starting point for building any real knowledge about what's happening in Iraq or across the Arab world. Our next guest has tried to do that in his new book, The Journey of the Jihadist. Fawaz Jerjes is a frequent commentator on ABC and NPR, and he is a professor at Sarah Lawrence College. Fawaz Jerjes, welcome back to Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Now, before we get to the book, obviously the news of the day as we tape this show, Al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been killed in Iraq. The media coverage is a little muddled. It's wall-to-wall, of course, but some folks are tentative about what the significance of this is. Where do you see Zarqawi in the larger story of this jihadi movement inside Iraq or even outside Iraq?
Zarqawi was a product of the American-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. Zarqawi was a product of the social upheaval in Iraq. He was the founding father of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the most senior military commander. He built Al-Qaeda out of nothing. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before the American-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. From day one, his strategy was to instigate a sectarian strife in the country and plunge Iraq into full sectarian strife and convince the Americans they could not win the war in Iraq. And I do hope that even though there is limited sectarian strife in Iraq, I do hope that Iraqis, and I do believe that Iraqis love their country and love their children, I do hope that Iraqis would prove Zarqawi and other radicals outside Iraq to be wrong and basically fight for their country and overcome their sectarian and communal differences.
This news recalled a Washington Post story from a few months back that revealed that there was a U.S. military campaign to increase Zarqawi's profile, a propaganda campaign to make him perhaps seem more important than he was.
If you really listen carefully to the commentary in the United States today since the killing of Zarqawi, you think that Zarqawi was the driver behind the Iraqi insurgency. You think that the elimination of the Zarqawi would hammer a deadly nail in the coffin of the insurgency. Nonsense. In fact, according to American military commanders, Zarqawi's men do not constitute more than 5%, just 5% out of the insurgency. The insurgency is almost 50,000 men. Zarqawi's men represent less than 5% of the 50,000 men. Not only that, I would go further. Even if you eliminate the entire Al-Qaeda base in Iraq, which is possible, I think the insurgency, basically the war in Iraq, will continue to be vibrant, dangerous, and lethal. And not only that, in fact, American military commanders now believe that the sectarian divide between Shiites and Sunnis has replaced the insurgency, the entire insurgency, not just Al-Qaeda, as the most dangerous fault line in Iraq.
Now, turning to your new book, it would seem to fill a rather significant void that exists in the media conversation about jihad and about Islam and the various strains of politically oriented Islam. One thing that you wrote, I think, suggests that this is a political story instead of a purely religious one. You wrote in the book, quote, "There is no direct correlation between religious fervor and militancy, despite what Western writers and journalists would like us to believe," close quote. Explain what you mean by that in the book.
You know, I think what Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda's number two, and Zarqawi would like us to believe, that basically they are the spokespersons for the Ummah being the Muslim community. Nonsense. In fact, Al-Qaeda does not speak for the entire jihadist movement, as I show in my book, Journey of the Jihadist. There was and there is a civil war taking place within the overall militant and jihadist movement. In fact, you cannot understand 9/11 without understanding this internal upheaval within the jihadist movement. I would go further, that 9/11 itself was part of the mutation within the jihadist movement. In fact, the killing of Zarqawi himself, according to American military intelligence, one of the leading Sunni insurgents gave Zarqawi away to the Iraqis and the American forces. And this tells you, this is the punchline, is that internal fault lines, even within the so-called the jihadist movement, the militant movements, are deep and hardened
Now, sometimes the terminology you use is important to understanding or even dissecting media. You spend some time in the book explaining what you mean when you use a term like Islamist or even jihad, which tend to have in popular media expression a purely negative meaning. You also spend some time talking about journalists who say things like the Arab street says this or that. Explain a little bit about that language.
My book is about voices. I mean, I let militants and jihadists tell their story in their own words. I let them express their grievances, their prejudices, their biases. Really, Journey of the Jihadist is a humble effort at understanding this, what I call the shadow universe, the militant universe that basically shattered America's peace of mind on 9/11. In fact, the jihadist represents a tiny minority within the Islamist movement. Mainstream Islamists who have renounced the use of force represents about 98% of the Islamist militants or jihadists represent about 2 or 3% within the Islamist movement. And there is a civil war taking place within this tiny jihadist movement. And what I try to do in the book, In Journey of the Jihadist, is to show the nuances, the complexities, the intensity of differences and tensions and cleavages within this tiny jihadist movement. Not all jihadists subscribe to Al-Qaeda strategy. If Al-Qaeda cannot speak for all militants and jihadists, surely Al-Qaeda cannot speak for all Islamists, let alone the Ummah, that is the Muslim community worldwide.
That is one of the fascinating things about the book, about the kind of the ideological and even tactical spectrum of this movement, the different thinking that exists. And when I was reading it, I was thinking about those days after 9/11 when many pundits and certainly politicians were saying it's not important to understand root causes, to ask why do they hate us is a waste of time. Obviously, you're suggesting that it's the key to understanding what's going on here.
I mean, how many Americans know that there is a civil strife, there is a major civil war within the jihadist movement? How many Americans know that the bulk of militants, those who really have nothing good to say about American foreign policy, viewed 9/11 as a disaster? How many Americans know that 9/11 was part of the mutation and the civil war that's taken place within the jihadist movement since 9/11? My book is a humble effort. Let them really hear the voices directly from the jihadists and the militants so that they understand Al-Qaeda does not speak for all militants, let alone for all Islamists, let alone for the Muslim community.
We've been speaking with Fawaz Jerjes. His new book is called Journey of the Jihadist. It's available now from Harcourt. You can find out more about the book at journeyofthejihadist.com. A link to that will be on FAIR's website. Fawaz Jerjes, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. You can listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart and myself, Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.